This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, the medical community is using their imagination and masking tape to get a preliminary glimpse of hospital expansions in the area. A Cape Bretoner who's been blind since birth is talking about the ups and downs of living through the pandemic, and we'll also hear about a program on the island that helps people who are struggling with the loss of a loved one. These stories are coming up on the Coast. The medical community is using mock-ups to see how hospital expansions will work in Glace Bay and Sydney. Spearheading the preliminary design is a registered nurse who also happens to be the CBRM Healthcare Redevelopment Project Clinical Director. Here is Troy Penny.
First of all, I'm actually a registered nurse. I've been practicing nursing since 2000. My involvement in healthcare goes way back actually to 1995, when the regional hospital first opened. I was, a struggling student going through university, and my parents kind of suggested that I actually volunteer help out at the regional hospital when it was first opening up, and ended up working in a department which is now called Medical Device Reprocessing. And so through my work experience working in that department, I was introduced to the operating room. You know, got to know some of the staff and that worked in the department in the operating room. And had the ability to actually see a couple surgeries. And I'm like, wow, this looks like an amazing profession, amazing ability that I could potentially kind of follow through with. So I chose and spoke to some of the nursing staff and decided to be here, to kind of follow that nursing, you know, path, I guess. And so did my nursing in Ontario. And once I finished nursing, I actually worked in a downtown operating room at the Toronto General Hospital, which is probably one of the largest teaching institutions in Canada. Spent 2 years in Toronto, saw some amazing things, transplantation, that type of amazing surgical procedures. And then once my, you know, wife and I started to, you know, we were expecting our first, decided to move closer to home, and the closest I could get to home was Halifax at the time. So spent a year working at the Victoria General Hospital in Halifax. And then once, you know, I was there long enough, I guess a year or so, found the opportunity or tried to find the opportunity to move home, and then was able to move home. Spent a little bit of time working in an emergency department at the Northside General, and then slowly transitioned myself over to the operating room, which was my kind of the history in the work experience that I have, and kind of worked through various levels of management in that area. I managed, ironically enough, I actually went back to manage the department I started my career in. So I managed medical device reprocessing. And then managed the operating room here at the Cape Breton Regional Hospital, and then was the director of perioperative services for the Eastern Zone for about a year. And then this amazing opportunity to be involved with redevelopment kind of came along, and decided to get involved with this. So that's kind of the Troy Penny story in a nutshell.
For your role as clinical director with the CBRM's Healthcare Redevelopment Project, you're involved with the expansions at the Glace Bay and the Cape Breton Regional Hospitals. Can you talk about those project goals, please, Troy?
Sure. The Cape Breton Regional Hospital, I'll start with that, and then I'll move on to Glace Bay if that works, is that the Cape Breton Regional Hospital was identified early on by government to see a renovation expansion of the emergency department and the cancer center and critical care. Now, once we started some of our functional planning and planning with our various user groups, we realized that renovations just don't work in these high stress, you know, high functioning departments. You know, the emergency department at the regional hospital would be a good example. Is that they've gone through a number of renovations, and the staff, when we started to meet with them, clearly identified that they were not willing and couldn't go through another renovation. And so a lot of the space that was actually initially pegged as a renovation turned into new builds. So we'll be building a new emergency department at the back of the regional hospital, as well as, you know, throughout the last while, we've added ORs, 9 new operating rooms will be included in that build. The new critical care department, women and children's, which includes kind of labor and delivery, neonatal intensive care, and 2 inpatient units. On top of that is actually a brand new standalone cancer center, which will be one of the first buildings constructed on the site. And then to power all these wonderful things, we're also building an energy center, which will be primarily using wood chips to actually help create some of the energy, steam, that type of energy, for the all of the entire campus. So the existing regional hospital, the cancer center, and the clinical service building will all be fed through this or from this one building. And then we go back in when all that work is done and do some renovations inside of the existing regional hospital. So that's the regional hospital in kind of a quick overrun. And then we're also at Glace Bay facility. We're actually, as you know, we opened a renal dialysis unit there. I think it was October 26, 2020 was when it actually opened. That was the initial start. And so we're still planning a brand new emergency department, which will be built to the side of the existing facility. And then we'll be going back into the facility itself and renovating the old ED to be part of surgical services. We'll be looking at medical device reprocessing because the OR and medical device reprocessing go hand in hand. And there'll be some, we'll say, casualties because of that renovation. And what I mean by that is that some of the space we need, for example, would be the pharmacy. So we'll be building a new pharmacy unit up on the third floor of the Glace Bay. So a lot of renovation work. A lot of exciting work still to come on both projects.
And it's interesting that you used a mock-up procedure to illustrate the expansion at the regional, and that took place at the former Scottsburn Dairy Plant. Can you talk about what did this exercise involve, and why did you choose that location?
So first of all, I'll kind of go with the location, then I'll kind of talk you through the mock-up process. Is that with this project, we are projecting a lot of equipment to be purchased throughout the project because I have own responsibility for Glace Bay and the regional hospital, but this office is also responsible for the work in North Sydney and New Watford as well. So we're expecting a lot of equipment that needs to be purchased in the future, and so we are anticipating the need for a storage facility. So we've actually leased this facility to Nova Scotia Lands, one of our partners, has leased this property for us to use for storage in the future. And so since we had this facility, for our use, we thought what an awesome opportunity to be able to conduct our mock-ups at that location. And so the mock-ups were actually a part of our design process. And so this entire, project is going through, various steps throughout a long process. And it starts with functional planning, where we meet with our user groups to talk about how what they need and the type of volumes that they're going to see in the future, and then we get into schematic designing, which is what the big box is going to look like, and then we get into detailed design, where we start looking at the small boxes inside that big box, and looking at equipment layouts, furniture, hallways, access, doorways, all those types of things. And then part of that process and part of detailed design is these mock-ups. And the mock-ups gives us and the clinical users of the space the ability to take words and drawings and actually get to see them and feel them and use them before it's actually constructed. It's so much easier to manipulate tape on the floor, to manipulate, we'll say, plastic walls rather than bricks and mortar. And so it gives us the ability to actually walk stretchers through the space, use equipment hanging from the ceiling to see how it's going to function in the space and see what the users feel and how they can actually, contribute to the overall design of the project.
And it's also interesting, Troy, that someone with a nursing background is spearheading this as opposed to an engineer or a building designer or an architect, because it's people in your profession that has the frontline knowledge and experience in an emergency environment. Is this a new approach when it comes to preliminary work for hospital expansions?
I'm not sure, but I guess I would be remiss to say that, I'm just a kind of one person in a large group of people, and we have the engineers and the architects and all those people that are involved with our projects. But to your point, clinically, it's, I think whoever designed this team and came up with this makeup was smart thinking this way, because you're right, is that clinically we are the people who are going to use the space once those folks are long and gone. And it's best to have, the users of that space help shape it, because, we're the ones who have to give that patient care And quite often we hear when we meet with our users is that, you know, we give wonderful care, you know, in Cape Breton and within our facilities, but quite often it's the infrastructure that is suffering. And so, you know, we are able to actually influence or help describe the wonderful care we give and then help to shape the infrastructure that we're going to do with it.
Okay, Troy, can we talk about the Highland Arts Theater? The HAT is a primary partner in this mock-up scenario. Why is their input so important and valuable to the vision for this hospital expansion?
Well, maybe I'll kind of give you a little bit of a history of how we got involved and try and explain why it's important. So when we were starting to plan these mock-ups, we were struggling with how we were going to mock up some of these, we'll call them lights and booms. So what they are know, pieces of equipment that hang from the ceilings or some of these large pieces of infrastructure that we actually require. And so we reached out to a supplier of that equipment, and they got us in contact with somebody out in British Columbia, I believe it was. And they had done some work with the Vancouver Opera House. And so we spoke to that individual who kind of steered us towards, you know, the Highland Arts Theater. And so it's kind of a match made in heaven a little bit, where they were able to actually take our vendor specs and actually craft them out of, you know, plastic and cardboard and those type of things and styrofoam. And so it gave our users the ability to actually put hands on of some of this equipment. And so it was so beneficial because, I mean, you got to think about what we were doing is that we were pretty much creating a live theater for our clinical users to actually go in and actually use this space. And so no one any better than someone who does it for a living than to create a surgical mock-up for us.
Troy, I wanted to make sure this was part of the conversation. If we can talk about your son, Lucas, he's in his first year of nursing at CBU. So there's a chance that when after graduation that he will actually be working in a facility thanks to your involvement and really part of your design.
It's exciting times to know that, you know, I will get to end my career probably seeing these abilities come to fruition, but to know that my son is going to get to be able to, you know, practice in these spaces is a very exciting. But it puts a little extra level of pressure on my shoulders. I don't want to have to hear once I retire that my son is not happy with the space that we actually were able to create for him. So it's a little added pressure, but it's very, very exciting. You know, he's going to be able to say and potentially brag someday that his father had a large part or a part in playing in the development of this space. So it is very exciting and to say the least.
Okay, Troy. And there's something else I'd like to ask you. On the program this week, we're speaking with Mr. John Yip from Inverness County. And John has been blind since birth. And when it comes to the preliminary work and the design stage for this project, do you keep people with disabilities in mind so that it would be a comfortable environment for them? For example, someone like John who lives with a visual impairment.
100%. We actually, as we go through the detailed design meetings, we actually have a representative from CNIB who actually partakes in the meetings to discuss some of the issues that they actually have or they want to see incorporate in our designs. And our design firm is very understanding and actually follow through with the information that they're giving for the individual. And she actually came up to the mock-ups and actually was taken around the mock-ups by the design firm. So she could give input into, you know, what she was being described and how she was being described. And so it was a, you know, very beneficial to have that individual involved. And besides those folks, we actually have a patient family advisory group that we work very heavily with out of this office. And so our patient family advisory group actually went through the mock-ups as well. I had a tour. And again, it's that patient lens, you know, as a clinician. Sometimes we focus so much on how we use the space, but we have to truly remember is that what we're doing is building this space for our patients. And so that group actually gives us that lens and helps us to focus on how they're going to actually use that space as well and how they're going to interact with it.
And by the way, of course, Troy, you were involved with the development of the new hospice. And if you add to that some of the provincial promises for healthcare in Cape Breton, in your opinion, or are you getting a sense that the community is becoming more confident that services will be available for them when families need them?
Yeah, you know, Bill, it's, you know, to your point and to your question earlier, is that all the various users that we're actually talking to, and, you know, clinically, patients, other key interest groups, their voices are being heard, and we're listening, and it seems like the government is listening. So it seems, to your point, that we are going to be able to create that care that people need, and actually have that care given in the proper location. So it seems to be the case that things seem to be going in that direction.
Okay, Troy. So that's about all the questions I had for you. Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about?
I think the only thing I would probably care to add would be that I just want to say thank you to so many people that are involved thus far in this project. You know, we've had surgeons, anesthesiologists, you know, PTOT, patients, you know, so many various groups come through that space, DI, even our own redevelopment team, you know, like I said, the engineers, the architects, you know, our public relations, Aaron, you know, there's so many people that have taken us so far in this project. And, you know, it's so heartwarming to see people's excitement when it comes to this project and the level of interest and excitement that people have. And so, you know, all I can do is say thank you. That's the only thing I can actually say is thank you from the bottom of my heart for all the hard work that they've done and continue to do around this project.
Okay, so we were just speaking with Troy Penny. Troy is a registered nurse and a clinical director with the CBRM Healthcare Redevelopment Project, and he was talking about the hospital expansions for Sydney and Glace Bay. Thanks for your time today, Troy.
Thanks, Bill. Really appreciate it.
John Yip is one of the more popular people in Inverness County, and he always sees the glass as half full, even while living through COVID-19 while visually impaired.
Hi, everybody. My name is John Yip. I'm coming to you from Inverness, Nova Scotia, Cape Breton Island, and I live in a long-term care facility, which is called the Inbury Manor in Inverness, Cape Breton. I'm residing in the Mountain View Villa. There's 11 other residents, and there's two CCAs on a day, and a nurse from 7 to 3 and 3 to 11, and they help me with all of my care, like dressing and such, things like that. And I've been totally visually impaired since birth. I'm 48 years of age, and my dad is also a resident in here. He's 84. I lived with him on Park Street, and I put my name in for the manor because I knew my dad was getting old and he was getting sick, and I decided to come to the manor because of that, and I'm glad I did. And 4 months later, who landed next door but my dad? He's 84 now, and he's said he's the best person he can ever be.
Oh, that's good, John. You get to spend time with your dad there. How is he enjoying his stay at the manor?
Well, he says it's duties. It's being at home with no duties. Like, he doesn't have to administer his own medication anymore. He doesn't have to do any cooking or cleaning or laundry or anything like that. It's all done for him. As he says, he gets assisted showers and warm towels.
Oh, that's good, John. You're just a short walk away. You don't have to leave the manor to go visit your dad.
He just lives right next door. I can go through my villa. We see each other every night. He comes down and we do something together. And sometimes he'll say, you know, if you want, I'll do this. Or if you want, I'll do that. But I always ask him, you know, like when my friends go, you know, when I go out, I say, well, I'm going out. Is there anything you need or anything you'd like? You know, he says he's the best person he can be at 84 years old today, and he owes it to this place for guidance.
And you're named after your dad, too. Is that right, John? You're John Jr., correct?
Oh, yeah. My mom, she was in the case room waiting for her to be transferred back to her room, and they said, we'll be there with you in a minute. That's 48 years ago. And they said, well, you better come now. There's something on the table. And I didn't know what it is. And Dr. N-G, P-A-I-L-L, I see how the spelling, right, said, "Wait, you better name him quick because I don't think he's going to make it." And they said, "Mom said, what is it, a boy, a girl, or an elf?" And he said, "Well, it's a boy." So she named him after my. I named me after my dad. And,
well, it seems like your mom chose wisely there, John. You certainly seem very proud of that. And it's very good that you had your dad, you had some family there during the lockdown when visitors couldn't come. But when you learned of the reopening phases developing, was it an exciting time for you to find out that loved ones and friends could visit you at the manor again?
Oh, yeah, my visitors. My mom comes in to visit me, and my friend Ruthie Doyle comes in to visit me twice a week, and she's double back, so they can't. She said she's going to continue wearing a mask even after they stop wearing them, because for her it's a security feature for most people around here. I feel bad that the nurses have to wear them 12 hours a day.
And that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, John, while living through COVID at the facility there. But overall, what was it like for you living through COVID?
Through COVID, we were locked down at the first of it for 18 weeks with no company, no visitors. And, I found the lockdown really hard because I found, like, when the visitors started, we were doing them outdoors for a half hour at a time, like would have to be 6 feet apart and would have to wear a mask, and it was hard hearing, and it really was hard. And
yes, and speaking of masks, John, I remember you had said before that you certainly don't mind wearing them, although they're not always comfortable. You're a strong supporter for people wearing masks.
I don't mind it. I like a certain type, and they have them at the door when you come in the Deanbury Manor here. There's an outside door where you can come in. They push a code to let you in, and if you're a visitor, they look at your vaccination record once, and you're put on a list.
Oh yes, COVID was so hard for most people to deal with. It must have been especially difficult for people living in a manor or a facility like that, John. But I've been watching you on social media, especially on Facebook, and you always have a very positive outlook, and the things you say are always very uplifting. And even though COVID was very difficult at times for you, you were recognized and celebrated for a very important milestone. And you said you're okay to talk. You said you'd like to speak to that. What was that occasion, John? Can you tell us about that, please?
One of the better things that happened was the manor here had arranged. We didn't know how we were going to do this. It was a big event for me. It was my 25th anniversary of sobriety. And they didn't know how they were going to arrange it. So somebody got together, and a gentleman from the program got together and gave me his 25-year medallion so I would have one. And we got pictures of it to prove that.
Wow, that's something else, say, John. The people who work there, they have such a difficult job and very long hours, yet they took the time to recognize you like that. That's really something special, isn't it?
Yes, they did, and it was people that they made sure that I was recognized, and people came and congratulated me, and they said, "We did what we could, even though it was COVID. We certainly made sure you were recognized." And I gave my mom my medallion to hold on to. I was so proud of that.
Yes, very well deserved there, John. And during the lockdown, you had mentioned as well that there's a special program that you have that allows you to text and email people. Can you talk about that, please?
Yes, I owe that to the help of the Canadian National Institute for the Blind's assistive technology specialist named Chris Judge, who taught me how to use the JAWS program. That stands for Job Access with Speech. I bought that program back in version 8, and I have been using it ever since. Actually, I just bought two more upgrades for it last week. I have to buy it every 2 years to keep it up to date. They give me... what I pay them for it, they give me 2 years of updates. Like they each year they come out with a new version, and if you don't buy your license, you don't get that new version. So I keep my license very up to date.
All right, good stuff there, John. I think that's pretty much all the questions I had. With the things reopening again, it seems like things are getting better there.
Well, I don't really. It's a little easier to get out now. I enjoy that because I can get out to the restaurant or go to the beach. I went to the beach in August when it was just early opening, and we didn't even have to carry. I don't even know we didn't have to carry proof of vaccine, but we had a sign. Like when they take us out of here, our friends have to sign us out and sign us back in.
So is that an easy process for you, John? Is that an easy thing to deal with?
Oh, yeah, it's not a problem. My friend just stops at the desk, and she says, I'm taking them, and she tells they don't ask where we're going. They give us, they just make sure that we have our vaccination papers, and they make sure I have picture ID on me and stuff such like that. And they also make sure, they issue me my proof of vaccination paper. They keep it at the desk in a file. And when I want it, I can ask for it, and it's issued to me.
All right. So, John, is there anything you'd like to say that I haven't asked you?
I'd just like to say that for anybody that's out there with COVID, anybody that's out there that hasn't been vaccinated, I would encourage them to get their vaccinations and get them now. Don't wait any longer. It's too long to wait for your vaccination. Now's the time to get them, because they're even coming out with a third booster for COVID. Right now, they're only working on residents in long-term care, but I imagine that will be out. And it saves the spread of COVID. It stops the spread. So when they come around to sign the paper, I signed it right away. I didn't hesitate. I didn't question it. I didn't anything like that. I didn't question it. I just said, I'll get double vaxxed. And they gave us a needle 1 month. They gave us a needle a month later. And now, last week, they asked us, would I sign for the booster? I said, of course so. That's the most important thing that I can't bestow on anybody. Please, please get vaccinated.
Okay, John, you know, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the time, and I hope to catch up with you soon again, my friend.
Thank you, Beth.
For over 30 years, the Bereaved Families of Cape Breton Society, a not-for-profit organization, has been providing bereavement support services at no cost to anyone grieving the loss of a loved one. Bereaved Families is run by a volunteer board of directors, staff, and trained facilitators. Liz Healy is the chair of the board of directors, and she's going to share more information about the services they provide.
Families is run by a volunteer board of directors, and we have trained volunteer facilitators, but we also, in our adolescent grief program that we provide, we are affiliated with Schools Plus. Bereaved Families established the program for the kids, but it's delivered by two social workers, Paula Boothlier, who is a member of our board of directors, and Lindsay Latham, and they're both social workers that work with Schools Plus.
Okay, Liz, and can you talk about some of the upcoming programs, please?
Okay, so our next session that's coming up, and which is Healing Through Movement Music for Women, that will be starting on November the 16th. And in order to reach us, I guess I probably should say where we're located. We're located at 188 George Street in the Father John Capstick Building. And when anyone is experiencing the loss of a loved one, they can phone 564-6795, and Maureen Guy, who is our program coordinator, will be there to answer the phone. And one of the things that with bereaved families, if you're in immediate distress at this point, we can refer you to, say, for example, it may be a crisis helpline such as 911, 211, Kids Helpline, a mental health crisis line, or a support and share session, and also enroll you in any of these programs that are upcoming. So right now, we're breaking it up in semesters this time. So we have a fall session, a winter session, and a spring session. So on November the 16th, we will be starting Healing Through Movement and Music. Then the next support and share will be on Monday, December the 6th, at Center 200 for the Sydney group. On the next for Glace Bay, which takes place at Townhouse, will be Tuesday, November the 30th. And the North Side group, the next one will be Wednesday, November the 17th. And that takes place via Zoom. Now, one of the things that, in order to find the link for that, you can go on our Facebook page and you'll find that. Also, if you have any questions whatsoever, to email us, and it's info@bfcb@gmail.com, and we are we will get back to you right away in a timely fashion. The next, in January, we are going to be starting our loss of a pet and loss of a child for the winter session on Healing Through Movement Music. It will be February the 22nd when this one is complete.
And Liz, experts will say that the grieving process is different for everyone, but can you talk about how important it is to take that first step and how difficult it must be for some people?
So Bill, it's a lot, and as you say, it's very difficult for some people to reach out for help. It's not, you go through this step of grieving, then you go on to the next step, then you go on to the next step. You can, it's like a flux. So basically you can be having a good day today and you think, okay, I'm moving on to the next step. And then 2 weeks from now, you're back to square one again. So there's no set pattern. Everyone grieves in their own time, and that's one thing that we really need to encourage here. And one of the things is that you're not alone. That's a big thing. You know, and some people, they may feel uncomfortable coming, but we've had people go into our programs and say, I just don't feel comfortable in sharing how I feel right now. And you know, by the end of the session, they're expressing how you know, this is how I felt. They're you know, and the group becomes cohesive by the end of the 6 weeks. And it's amazing to see how people have progressed. So one of the, I think I'll talk, and this was back probably about 4 years ago, I guess. And so about 4 years ago, there was a young adolescent had lost his dad. His mom was not coping properly, couldn't provide support for him, both emotionally, physically. The child was unable to, you know, do their schoolwork. They were falling behind. So mom went to support and share, and that helped her. Then she went into the program Loss of a Spouse and also Healing Through Movement Music. So then she was able to become a functioning member of society again, was able to go back to work, was able to support her child. And the young child, you know, went through the adolescent program. But unfortunately, through COVID, mom passed away. So then it was the situation, and we were coming on to the end when we were getting back to school. So we put this child through the program again. And they, you know, and this is when they develop, you know, a support system. They receive tools to help them cope with their grief, you know. And then you see them coming along. I spoke with Lindsay last night, actually, and she said that it was with the middle school. And I mean, when you think about it, this child, that I mentioned was in middle school. So to think about this, I've had someone say to me, I wish that I had the opportunity to go to a group such as bereaved families when, you know, I lost my twin brother and I was in high school, because I think if I had this opportunity, I probably would have, you know, developed a little bit, probably coping skills, things like that, you know. And right now, with the situation where we have, with the kids, that the two young girls that perished in the fire in Glace Bay, that impacts everything. And we're working now. They reached out to us, and I'm actually meeting with the schools tomorrow, as well with the social worker Lindsay Latham, to see what we can do to help the kids and what are their needs right now, to help, because these kids, it's not only is it affecting Glace Bay, it's affecting New Waterford, it's affecting Sydney Academy, because nowadays kids have their own network, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Instagram, all of these other forums, right? So as opposed to years ago when I was in school, you know, you didn't have the opportunity of a computer, or you basically stayed in your own community. So one of the things that they're using right now is they've introduced the Adolescent Grief App, but we're working with them now to see what we can provide for them.
Liz, do you hear a lot in the discussions about how some people may blame themselves in some way for the loss of someone they know very well?
Okay, so I'll give you a little background on myself. I'm an ICU nurse, and I work at the regional hospital. So I have gone through wave one of COVID, wave two, wave three, and now wave four, right? We're journeying through wave four right now. So you have people that have lost a loved one pre-COVID. And people then that went into wave one where, you know, here you are, you're in a situation where there's one person that's allowed to visit, and that's it. So a lot of people are dealing with survivor's guilt and the fact that, well, you were the, and you're seeing some issues with families as well, because you were the chosen person that got to spend the last few hours or minutes with your loved one. So how difficult is that? And there are some people that, yes, blame themselves, like, you know, I wish I had been able to be there. We went through the first wave where no one was allowed to visit. Not one person was allowed to visit. And in an ICU, you know, you're dealing with situations where it's quite critical, and it is life and death at that point, right? So then you have one of the things that we do, because we're social beings, when someone passes away, whether it's your neighbor, whether it's your loved one, people gather and they support each other. And people were unable to do that. So now, you know, and like I said, it's so difficult. Even with funerals, you know, they were only allowed to have five people attend the funeral. It's devastating. So, and one of the things too, and like I said, with Maureen, our program coordinator, who's wonderful, she received some calls actually during that time. One person was actually suicidal, and she got them help. And, you know, they thanked her afterwards and came to support and share. And, you know, and were, you know, they came into the program. And so, and it's very satisfying to see that you're helping people. And I think a lot of the times people are unaware of bereaved families, because it's not something that is a happy time for them. And it's also, you're dealing with mental health, right? And we are getting now referrals. From before, we had referrals from physicians, but now it's more so. And now we're getting the word out that, yes, we are here. Are you grieving? has someone you love died, well, then we can provide the help that you need. And that is, that's one of the things, if I can't stress enough, you know, call, enroll in the programs, you know, we're there, we're always looking at what we can do to help. What else can we use? What are the other tools that we can provide for people? You know, so, and like I said, a lot of the times too, and people don't think, some people feel, oh, well, it's just a pet. Well, it's not just a pet. A lot of pets are family members, right? And we haven't been able to provide that program for years, because you have to remember, we had been receiving $25,000 plus per year from the United Way of Cape Breton, and we are now reduced to $1,500, maybe $2,000. And the only thing is that it would fit would be the adolescent program, because it's dealing with, it's specific now to child poverty, and we could come in under that umbrella. But like I said, you know, it's, grief is not something that people want to talk about, you know, because it's something that they feel that, oh my gosh, people are going to think that I'm a little crazy if I'm still suffering the loss. I just wish that I had known about bereaved families, because how I became involved with bereaved families, I do a lot of volunteering in the community, and I was asked to assist them to try and do some fundraising. So then I decided, well, I would join the board, because I was unaware of bereaved families. And I lost both my parents within 5 months of each other in 2004, and I would have gladly, you know, when I look back on that year, it was a blur, and I'm an only child as well, so therefore you have your support system, and all of a sudden, you know, and it doesn't matter how old you were, you know, when you lose your parent, or if you lose your spouse, or if you lose a child could be 36 years old. So I think a lot of times people feel with loss of a child, well, it's a baby, it's a young child, but it's not. And, you know, and this is one of the things I'm very excited about, is the fact that we are able to help so many people by providing all of these programs.
Liz, what would you have to say to someone who feels that their life has become meaningless, and they may feel like they don't even want to go on after losing someone very close to them? Is that something that you deal with as well?
We do. I know Maureen has gotten a lot of calls. During COVID, actually, we received a phone call from Family Services in Annie Ganesh, can you help? Because they had a situation where, you know, there was a death of a young person in their 30s. They lost their husband, and, you know, what can we provide for them? But a lot of people, they just feel like my life is meaningless now, you know, and when they get together and they talk to people who basically have suffered the same, you know, if it's their parent, if it's their child, if it's their spouse or partner, you know, they realize then that, you know what, you're feeling this, we're all feeling the same way, and I went through this. And, you know, and sometimes, like in the groups, you know, it can be quite emotional for them. But you know what, when they realize that they are there, they're not alone, and they have people to support them, and people that have undergone the same thing, you know, it helps them get through their grief.
And it's really hard to imagine, or it's hard to know what some people are dealing with, the wide range of emotions that they're experiencing with the loss of a loved one. Is it important too to try to encourage people to try as much as possible to have to maintain a normal lifestyle in during the grieving process?
Yes, definitely. I know some people I find, maybe, you know, they'll say to you, well, get over it, my God, this is so many years ago. Well, you know, you lost your pet, it's only a pet, for example. You lost your husband, it was 12 years ago, you know. to try and minimize it, but it's not. People should not do that. It doesn't matter when it happens. People need to try and move on. And this is basically a way of them doing this, because they're provided with tools, and they can put them in a tool in their toolbox to help them get through. And you know what? Maybe you're having a bad time, and support and share is tomorrow night. But I'm from Glace Bay, but it's happening in Sydney. Well, you know what? You have the opportunity to go, or pick up that phone and call Maureen. And she's there on the other line to help you. That is the thing. And like I said, you know, if it's something that's immediate, that needs to, you know, for example, if she feels she needs to phone 911, she will. If it's someone that they're happening, you know, if it's something that's very, very, very a dire situation, well, she'll get you the help that you need. Right, whether it be calling someone, have someone phone you, that's, you know, a counselor or whatever, you know, that's what we're here to do. And one of the things that we also did was during people that were under probation services, some of these people attended our support and share because it was part of their program that they had to reach out and attend grief counseling. And we've actually helped people through that program. So we're going to look at doing something, working with the with probation services and with the police, and forging a partnership to see how can we help. The other thing that Bereaved Families does, we have gone to Under One Umbrella. And, you know, it's very sad to see. We've spoken with people, and you know, you have someone come up to you and they talk to you and they're homeless. And, you know, a lot of this happens because of unresolved grief and what they've gone through, you know. So, like I said, we're always there to help. And it doesn't matter who you are. You know, this is the service that we provide, and we want to help as many people as we possibly can.
And Liz, if I can follow up on something here, I wanted to ask you about, although the grieving process, we see this as an emotional journey, but there are situations where people can experience physical harm and physical challenges while they're in the grieving process. Is that right?
Yes, when you're grieving, a lot of times unresolved grief, you can get to the point where you become very, very depressed. You can't function in society. You basically curtain yourself off from everyone and stay in your home. You may not be able to go out in public. You may want to sleep all the time. It can manifest itself as whether it be, you know, severe headaches, whether it be GI problems, whether, you know, I remember when, after my father passed away, I'll just to give an example. My mom and dad, I mean, they had been married for 43 years. And, you know, I always thought, and like I said, my dad dropped dead in the house. And my mother, she started to lose weight. And she wasn't eating properly. And they thought it was because of the grief, because she was mourning for the loss of my dad. But it turned out that she did have cancer. But those are other symptoms. You know, a lot of times, too, people they become very, they don't want to go out in the house. They don't want to, they don't want to join in on groups. Maybe their socialization just isn't something that they don't want to do, because a lot of times some people will say to them, well, you know, it's say, for example, it's a year, it's 6 months, it's 2 years. You need to get over this, and you need to. But that's not what you need to say to these people. They're basically, you know, reaching out for help, and this is a cry for help for them, and you know, and that's why it is so important for anyone that's undergoing, anything like this that they need, you know, they really need to the support from those that are around them. But I'm going to, one of the things is, when people get bereavement support, many of the socioeconomic costs of unresolved grief can be avoided. And the thing is, it's unresolved grief is also, it's impacted as a factor in many behavioral and physical diagnoses and depression and recurring illness. Like, say, for example, I may feel that I have this, I have something wrong with me. And, you know, you're going back and forth and back and forth, you know, to the doctor. But basically, it's grief, and grief will can manifest itself in physical symptoms.
Okay, thanks, Liz. And if I can move on to the community involvement here, something that you and your group relies on very much, what would you like to say about the donation process?
Okay, well, we rely on private donations. We were very lucky this year that we received federal funding and provincial funding. But, you know, we always need funding for because that's how we pay our staff as well. We only have two staff that and the rest is all volunteer. And the other way that we receive funding is we apply for grants, whether it's through the health boards, through the federal government, through provincial government. That's how we do it. I don't know if you're familiar with Garbage Night, but that was something that Jen Shepherd, Jordan Crocker, and Stephen Muse, they did weekly, and they gave donations to charitable organizations, and we were the benefactors of Garbage Night, and we received $10,000 from them. Also, they donated two iPads, and that is, and the iPads are used in the Adolescent Grief Program. So it's like I said, it's through the generosity of the public. It's through grants, it's through fundraisers that we do ourselves. But if you wanted to give a donation to bereaved families, you can do so. You can come to the office, and we will give a receipt for that.
Okay, thanks, Liz. So on Dialogue this week, we're speaking with Liz Healy with the Board of Directors of Bereaved Families. And she was getting us up to speed on some of the services the organization provides. And if you're interested in making a donation to bereaved families, they have charitable status with the Canada Revenue Agency, and they currently accept donations by way of e-transfer to infobfcb@gmail.com. That's infobfcb@gmail.com. And you can also call their office at 902-564-6795 to find out other ways you can donate. Thanks so much for your time today, Liz. It was nice talking to you.
Thank you, Bill.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.